leaving that morning to take up his quarters at the Stylites' Arms until he should have completed his plans.
"And really, it's a great relief to think he's going, Hastings,"
continued my honest friend.
"It was bad enough before when we thought he'd done it, but I'm hanged if it isn't worse now when we all feel guilty for having been so down on the fellow. The fact is, we've treated him abominably. Of course, things did look black against him. I don't see how anyone can blame us for jumping to the conclusions we did. Still, there it is. We were in the wrong, and now there's a beastly feeling that one ought to make amends, which is difficult when one doesn't like the fellow a bit better than one did before. The whole thing's damned awkward, and I'm thankful he's had the tact to take himself off. It's a good thing Styles wasn't the matters to leave to him. Couldn't bear to think of the fellow lording it here. He's welcome to her money."
"You'll be able to keep up the place all right?" I asked.
"Oh, yes. There are the death duties, of course, but half my father's money goes with the place, and Lawrence will stay with us for the present, so there is his share as well. We shall be pinched at first, of course, because, as I once told you, I am in a bit of a hole financially myself. Still, the Johnnies will wait now."
In the general relief at Inglethorpe's approaching departure, we had the most genial breakfast we had experienced since the tragedy. Cynthia, whose young spirits were naturally buoyant, was looking quite her pretty self again, and we all, with the exception of Florence, who seemed unalterably gloomy and nervous, were quietly cheerful at the opening of a new and hopeful future. The papers, of course, had been full of the tragedy. Glaring headlines sandwiched biographies of every member of the household, subtle innuendos, the usual familiar tag about the police having a clue. Nothing was spared us. It was a slack time. The war was momentarily inactive, and the newspapers seized with avidity on this crime in fashionable life. The mysterious affair at Styles was the topic of the moment. Naturally, it was very annoying for the Cavendishes. The house was constantly besieged by reporters who were consistently denied admission, but who continued to haunt the village and the grounds where they lay in wait with cameras for any unwary members of the household. We all lived in a blast of publicity. The Scotland Yard man came and went, examining, questioning, lynx-eyed and reserved of tongue. Towards what end they were working, we did not know. Had they any clue, or would the whole thing remain in the category of undiscovered crimes? After breakfast, Dorcas came up to me rather mysteriously and asked if she might have a few words with me.
"Certainly. What is it, Dorcas?"
"Well, it's just this, sir. You'll be seeing the Belgian gentleman today, perhaps."
I nodded.
"Well, sir, you know how he asked me so particular if the mistress or anyone else had a green dress?"
"Yes, yes. You have found one?" My interest was aroused.
"No. Not that, sir. But since then I've remembered what the young gentleman—"
John and Lawrence were still the young gentleman to Dorcas.
"Call the dressing-up box. It's up in the front attic, sir. A great chest full of all clothes and fancy dresses and what not. And it came to me sudden like that there might be a green dress amongst them. So if you'd tell the Belgian gentleman—"
"I will tell him, Dorcas," I promised.
"Thank you very much, sir. A very nice gentleman he is, sir, and quite as different class from them two detectives from London, what goes prying about and asking questions. I don't hold with foreigners as a rule, but from what the newspapers say, I make out as how these brave Belgies isn't the ordinary run of foreigners, and certainly he's a most polite-spoken gentleman."
Dear old Dorcas. As she stood there, with her honest face upturned to mine, I thought what a fine specimen she was of the old-fashioned servant that is so fast dying out. I thought I might as well go down to the village at once and look up Poirot, but I met him halfway coming up to the house and at once gave him Dorcas's message.
"Ah, the brave Dorcas. We will look at the chest, although, but no matter, we will examine it all the same."
We entered the house by one of the windows. There was no one in the hall, and we went straight up to the attic. Sure enough, there was a chest, a fine old piece, all studded with brass nails and full to overflowing with every imaginable type of garment. Poirot bundled everything out on the floor with scant ceremony. There was one or two green fabrics of varying shades, but Poirot shook his head over them all. He seemed somewhat apathetic in the search, as though he expected no great results from it. Suddenly he gave an exclamation. "What is it?"
"Look."
The chest was nearly empty, and there, reposing right at the bottom, was a magnificent black beard.
"Huh?"
said Poirot.
"Huh?"
He turned it over in his hands, examining it closely.
"New,"
he remarked.
"Yes, quite new."
After a moment's hesitation, he replaced it in the chest, heaped all the other things on top of it as before, and made his way briskly downstairs. He went straight to the pantry, where we found Dorcas busily polishing her silver. Poirot wished her good morning with Gallic politeness, and went on.
"We have been looking through the chest, Dorcas. I'm much obliged to you for mentioning it. There is indeed a fine collection there. Are they often used, may I ask?"
"Well, sir, not very often nowadays, though from time to time we do have what the young gentlemen call a dress-up night. And very fun it is sometimes, sir. Mr. Lawrence is wonderful. Most comic. I shall never forget the night he came down as the Tsar of Persia, I think he called it, a sort of Eastern king it was. He had the big paper knife in his hand, and, 'Mind, Dorcas,' he says, 'you'll have to be very respectful. This is my specially sharpened scimitar, and it's off with your head if I'm at all displeased with you.' Miss Cynthia, she was what they call an Apache, or some such name. A Frenchified sort of cutthroat, I take it to be. A real sight she looked. You'd never have believed a pretty young lady like that could have made herself into such a ruffian. Nobody would have known her."
"These events must have been great fun," said Poirot genially. "I suppose Mr. Lawrence wore that fine black beard in the chest upstairs when he was Shah of Persia."
"He did have a beard, sir," replied Dorcas, smiling. "And well I know it, for he borrowed 2 skeins of my black wool to make it with. And I'm sure it looked wonderfully natural at a distance. I didn't know as there was a beard up there at all. It must have been got quiet lately, I think. There was a red wig, I know, but nothing else in the way of hair. Burnt corks they use mostly, though 'tis messy getting it off again. Miss Cynthia was a nigger once, and oh, the trouble she had!"
"So Dorcas knows nothing about that black beard,"
said Poirot thoughtfully, as we walked out into the hall again. "Do you think it is the one?" I whispered eagerly. Poirot nodded.
"I do. You notice it had been trimmed?"
"No."
"Yes. It was cut exactly the shape of Mr. Inglethorpe's, and I found 1 or 2 snipped hairs. Hastings, this affair is very deep."
"Who put it in the chest, I wonder?"
"Someone with a good deal of intelligence," remarked Poirot dryly. "You realize that he chose the one place in the house to hide it where its presence would not be remarked. Yes, he is intelligent. But we must be more intelligent. We must be so intelligent that he does not suspect us of being intelligent at all."
I acquiesced.
"Then, mon ami, you will be of great assistance to me."
I was pleased with the compliment. There had been times when I hardly thought that Poirot appreciated me at my true worth.
"Yes,"
he continued, staring at me thoughtfully,
"you will be invaluable."
This was naturally gratifying, but Poirot's next words were not so welcome.
"I must have an ally in the house,"
he observed reflectively. "You have me," I protested.
"True. But you're not sufficient."
I was hurt, and showed it. Poirot hurried to explain himself.
"You do not quite take my meaning. You are known to be working with me. I want somebody who is not associated with us in any way."
"Oh, I see. How about John?"
"No, I think not."
"The dear fellow isn't perhaps very bright," I said thoughtfully.
"Here comes Miss Howard,"
said Poirot suddenly.
"She is the very person. But I am in her black books since I cleared Mr. Inglethorpe. Still, we can but try."
With a nod that was barely civil, Miss Howard assented to Poirot's request for a few minutes' conversation. We went into the little morning room, and Poirot closed the door.
"Well, Monsieur Poirot," said Miss Howard impatiently, "what is it? Out with it. I'm busy."
"Do you remember, mademoiselle, that I once asked you to help me?"
"Yes, I do,"
the lady nodded.
"And I told you I'd help you with pleasure, to hang Alfred Inglethorpe."
"Ah,"
Poirot studied her seriously.
"Miss Howard, I will ask you one question. I beg of you to reply to it truthfully."
"Never tell lies," replied Miss Howard.
"It is this. Do you still believe that Mrs. Inglethorpe was poisoned by her husband?"
"What do you mean?"
she asked sharply.
"You needn't think your pretty explanations influence me in the slightest. I'll admit that it wasn't he who bore the strychnine at the chemist's shop. What of that? I dare say he soaked fly-paper, as I told you at the beginning."
"That is arsenic, not strychnine,"
said Poirot mildly.
"What does that matter? Arsenic would put poor Emily out of the way just as well as strychnine. If I'm convinced he did it, it doesn't matter a jot to me how he did it."
"Exactly. If you are convinced he did it," said Poirot quietly, "I will put my question in another form. Did you ever, in your heart of hearts, believe that Mrs. Inglethorpe was poisoned by her husband?"
"Good heavens!" cried Miss Howard. "Haven't I always told you the man is a villain? Haven't I always told you he would murder her in her bed? Haven't I always hated him like poison?"
"Exactly," said Poirot. "That bears out of my little idea entirely."
"What little idea?"
"Miss Howard, do you remember a conversation that took place on the day of my friend's arrival here? He repeated it to me, and there is a sentence of yours that has impressed me very much. Do you remember affirming that if a crime had been committed and anyone you loved had been murdered, you felt certain that you would know by instinct who the criminal was, even if you were quite unable to prove it?"
"Yes, I remember saying that. I believe it, too. I suppose you think it nonsense."
"Not at all."
"And yet you will pay no attention to my instinct against Alfred Inglethorpe?"
"No,"
said Poirot curtly.
"Because your instinct is not against Mr. Inglethorpe."
"What?"
"No. You wish to believe he committed the crime. You believe him capable of committing it. But your instinct tells you he did not commit it. It tells you more. Shall I go on?"
She was staring at him, fascinated, and made a slight affirmative movement of the hand.
"Shall I tell you why you have been so vehement against Mr. Inglethorpe? It is because you are trying to drown and stifle your instinct, which tells you another name."
"No, no, no,"
cried Miss Howard wildly, flinging up her hands.
"Don't say it, oh, don't say it. It isn't true. It can't be true. I don't know what put such a wild, such a dreadful idea into my head."
"I'm right, am I not?"
asked Poirot.
"Yes, yes, you must be a wizard to have guessed. But it can't be so. It's too monstrous, too impossible. It must be Alfred Inglethorpe."
Poirot shook his head gravely.
"Don't ask me about it,"
continued Miss Howard,
"because I shan't tell you. I won't admit it, even to myself. I must be mad to think of such a thing."
Poirot nodded as if satisfied.
"I will ask you nothing. It is enough for me that it is as I thought. And I too, have an instinct. We are working together towards a common end."
"Don't ask me to help you, because I won't. I wouldn't lift a finger to...
She faltered.
"You will help me in spite of yourself. I ask you nothing, but you will be my ally. You will not be able to help yourself. You will do the only thing that I want of you."
"And that is?"
"You will watch."
Evelyn Howard bowed her head.
"Yes, I can't help doing that. I'm always watching, always hoping I shall be proved wrong."
"If we are wrong, well and good," said Poirot. "No one will be more pleased than I shall. But if we are right, If we are right, Miss Howard, on whose side are you then?
I don't know. I don't know. Come now. It could be hushed up.
There must be no hushing up.
But Emily herself...
She broke off.
Miss Howard, said Poirot gravely, this is unworthy of you.
Suddenly she took her face from her hands.
Yes,
she said quietly.
That was not Evelyn Howard who spoke.
She flung her head as proudly.
This is Evelyn Howard, and she is on the side of justice. Let the cost be what it may.
And with these words she walked firmly out of the room.
There, said Poirot, looking after her, goes a very valuable ally. That woman, Hastings, has got brains as well as a heart.
I did not reply.
Instinct is a marvellous thing,
mused Poirot.
It can neither be explained nor ignored.
You and Miss Howard seem to know what you are talking about, I observed coldly. Perhaps you don't realize that I am still in the dark.
Really? Is that so, mon ami?
Yes, enlighten me, will you? Poirot studied me attentively for a moment or two. Then, to my intense surprise, he shook his head decidedly.
No, my friend.
Oh, look here, why not?
Two is enough for a secret.
Well, I think it is very unfair to keep back facts from me.
I am not keeping back facts. Every fact that I know is in your possession. You can draw your own deductions from them. This time it is a question of ideas.
Still, it would be interesting to know. Poirot looked at me very earnestly and again shook his head.
You see,
he said sadly,
you have no instincts.
It was intelligence you were requiring just now, I pointed out.
The two often go together, said Poirot enigmatically.
The remark seemed so utterly irrelevant that I did not even take the trouble to answer it. But I decided that if I made any interesting and important discoveries, as no doubt I should, I would keep them to myself and surprise Poirot with the ultimate result. There are times when it is one's duty to assert oneself. Chapter 9. Dr. Bauerstein. I had had no opportunity as yet of passing on Poirot's message to Lawrence, but now, as I strolled out on the lawn, still nursing a grudge against my friend's high-handedness, I saw Lawrence on the croquet lawn, aimlessly knocking a couple of very ancient balls about with a still more ancient mallet. It struck me that it would be a good opportunity to deliver my message. Otherwise, Poirot himself might relieve me of it. It was true that I did not quite gather its purport, but I flattered myself that by Lawrence's reply and perhaps a little skilful cross-examination on my part, I should soon perceive its significance. Accordingly, I accosted him. "I've been looking for you," I remarked untruthfully.
"Have you?"
"Yes, the truth is, I've got a message for you from Poirot."
"Yes?"
"He told me to wait until I was alone with you," I said, dropping my voice significantly and watching him intently out of the corner of my eye. I have always been rather good at what is called, I believe, creating an atmosphere.
"Well?"
There was no change of expression in the dark, melancholic face. Had he any idea of what I was about to say? "This is the message." I dropped my voice still lower. "Find the extra coffee cup, and you can rest in peace."
"What on earth does he mean?"
Lawrence stared at me in quite unaffected astonishment. "Don't you know?"
"Not in the least." "Do you?"
I was compelled to shake my head.
"What extra coffee cup?"
"I don't know."
"You'd better ask Dorcas or one of the maids if he wants to know about coffee cups. It's their business, not mine. I don't know anything about the coffee cups, except that we've got some that are never used, which are a perfect dream. Old Worcester, you're not a connoisseur, are you, Hastings?"
I shook my head.
"You miss a lot. A really perfect bit of old china. It's pure delight to handle it, or even to look at it."
"Well, what am I to tell Poirot?"
"Tell him I don't know what he's talking about. It's double Dutch to me."
"All right." I was moving off towards the house again when he suddenly called me back.
"I say, what was the end of that message? Say it over again, will you?"
Find the extra coffee cup and you can rest in peace. Are you sure you don't know what it means? I asked him earnestly. He shook his head.
No,
he said musingly.
I don't. I wish I did.
The boom of the gong sounded from the house and we went in together. Poirot had been asked by John to remain to lunch and was already seated at the table. By tacit consent, all mention of the tragedy was bad. We conversed on the war and other outside topics. But after the cheese and biscuits had been handed round and Dorcas had left the room, Poirot suddenly leant forward to Mrs. Cavendish.
"Pardon me, madame, for recalling unpleasant memories, but I have a little idea."
Poirot's little ideas were becoming a perfect byword.
"And would like to ask one or two questions."
"Of me?"
"Certainly. You are too amiable, madame. What I want to ask is this. The door leading into Mrs. Ingersoll's room from that of Mademoiselle Cynthia, it was bolted, you say?"
"Certainly it was bolted," replied Mary Cavendish, rather surprised. "I said so at the inquest."
"Bolted?"
"Yes."
She looked perplexed.
"I mean," explained Poirot, "you are sure it was bolted, and not merely locked?"
"Oh, I see what you mean. No, I don't know. I said bolted, meaning that it was fastened, and I could not open it, but I believe all the doors were found bolted on the inside."
"Still, as far as you are concerned, the door might equally well have been locked."
"Oh, yes."
"You yourself did not happen to notice, madame, when you entered Mrs. Ingersoll's room, whether that door was bolted or not?"
I believe it was."
"But you did not see it?"
"No, I never looked."
"But I did," interrupted Lawrence suddenly. "I happened to notice that it was bolted."
"Ah, that settles it."
And Poirot looked crestfallen. I could not help rejoicing that, for once, one of his little ideas had come to naught. After lunch, Poirot begged me to accompany him home. I consented rather stiffly.
"You are annoyed, is it not so?"
he asked anxiously as we walked through the park. "Not at all," I said coldly.
"That is well. That lifts a great load from my mind."
This was not quite what I had intended. I had hoped that he would have observed the stiffness of my manner. Still, the fervour of his words went towards the appeasing of my just displeasure, I thought. "I gave Lawrence your message," I said.
"And what did he say? He was entirely puzzled."
"Yes, I am quite sure he had no idea what you meant." I had expected Poirot to be disappointed, but to my surprise, he replied that that was as he had thought and that he was very glad. My pride forbade me to ask any questions. Poirot switched off on another track.
"Mademoiselle Cynthia was not at lunch today. How was that?"
"She is at the hospital again. She resumed work today."
"Ah, she is an industrious little demoiselle. And pretty, too. She is like pictures I have seen in Italy. I would rather like to see that dispensary of hers. Do you think she would show it to me?"
"I'm sure she would be delighted. It's an interesting little place."
"Does she go there every day?"
"She has all Wednesdays off and comes back to lunch on Saturdays. Those are her only times off."
"I will remember. Women are doing great work nowadays, and Mademoiselle Cynthia is clever. Oh, yes, she has brains, that little one."
"Yes, I believe she has passed quite a stiff exam."
"Without doubt. After all, it is very responsible work. I suppose they have very strong poisons there."
"Yes, she showed them to us. They are kept locked up in a little cupboard. I believe they have to be very careful. They always take out the key before leaving the room."
"Indeed. It is near the window, this cupboard."
"No, right the other side of the room. Why?" Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"I wondered, that is all. Will you come in?"
We had reached the cottage. "No, I think I'll be getting back. I shall go round the long way through the woods." The woods round Stiles were very beautiful. After the walk across the open park, it was pleasant to saunter lazily through the cool glades. There was hardly a breath of wind. The very chirp of the birds was faint and subdued. I strolled on a little way, and finally flung myself down at the foot of a grand old beech tree. My thoughts of mankind were kindly and charitable. I even forgave Poirot for his absurd secrecy. In fact, I was at peace with the world. Then I yawned. I thought about the crime, and it struck me as being very unreal and far off. I yawned again. Probably, I thought, it really never happened. Of course, it was all a bad dream. The truth of the matter was that it was Lawrence who had murdered Alfred Inglethorpe with a croquet mallet. But it was absurd of John to make such a fuss about it and to go shouting out, "I tell you I won't have it!" I woke up with a start. At once I realized that I was in a very awkward predicament. For about 12 feet away from me, John and Mary Cavendish were standing facing each other, and they were evidently quarrelling. And quite as evidently they were unaware of my vicinity, for before I could move or speak, John repeated the words which had aroused me from my dream.
"I tell you, Mary, I won't have it!"
Mary's voice came, cool and liquid.
"Have you any right to criticize my actions?"
"It will be the talk of the village. My mother was only buried on Saturday, and here you are gadding about with a fellow."
"Oh," she shrugged her shoulders, "if it is only village gossip that you mind."
"But it isn't. I've had enough of the fellow hanging about. He's a Polish Jew, anyway."
"A tinge of Jewish blood is not a bad thing. It leavens the," she looked at him, "stolid stupidity of the ordinary Englishman."
Fire in her eyes, ice in her voice. I did not wonder that the blood rose to John's face in a crimson tide.
"Mary!"
"Well?"
Her tone did not change. The pleading died out of his voice.
"Am I to understand that you will continue to see Bauerstein against my express wishes?"
"If I choose."
"You defy me."
"No, but I deny your right to criticize my actions. Have you no friends of whom I should disapprove?"
John fell back a pace. The colour ebbed slowly from his face.
"What do you mean?"
he said, in an unsteady voice.
"You see," said Mary quietly, "you do see, don't you, that you have no right to dictate to me as to the choice of my friends?"
John glanced at her pleadingly, a stricken look on his face.
"No right? Have I no right, Mary?"
he said unsteadily. He stretched out his hands.
"Mary!"
For a moment, I thought she wavered. A softer expression came over her face. Then suddenly she turned almost fiercely away.
"None!"
She was walking away when John sprang after her and caught her by the arm.
"Mary!"
His voice was very quiet now.
"Are you in love with this fellow Bauerstein?"
She hesitated, and suddenly there swept across her face a strange expression, old as the hills, yet with something eternally young about it. So might some Egyptian sphinx have smiled. She freed herself quietly from his arm and spoke over her shoulder.
"Perhaps,"
she said, and then swiftly passed out of the little glade, leaving John standing there as though he had been turned to stone. Rather ostentatiously I stepped forward, crackling some dead branches with my feet as I did so. John turned. Luckily, he took it for granted that I had only just come upon the scene.
"Hello, Hastings. Have you seen the little fellow safely back to his cottage? Quaint little chap. Is he any good, though, really?"
"He was considered one of the finest detectives of his day."
"Oh, well, I suppose there must be something in it, then. What a rotten world it is, though."
"You find it so?" I asked.
"Good Lord, yes. There's this terrible business to start with. Scotland Yard men, in and out of the house like a jack-in-the-box. Never know where they won't turn up next. Screaming headlines in every paper in the country. Damn old journalists, I say. Do you know there was a whole crowd staring in near the lodge gates this morning? Sort of Madame Tussaud chamber of horrors business that can be seen for nothing. Pretty thick, isn't it?"
"Cheer up, John," I said soothingly. "It can't last for ever."
"Can't it, though? It can last long enough for us never to be able to hold up our heads again."
"No, no, you're getting morbid on the subject."
"Enough to make a man morbid, to be stalked by beastly journalists and stared at by gaping moon-faced idiots, wherever he goes. There's worse than that."
"What?" John lowered his voice.
"Have you ever thought, Hastings? It's a nightmare to me. Who did it?
I can't help feeling sometimes it must have been an accident, because who could have done it? Now Inglethorpe's out of the way. There's no one else. No one, I mean, except one of us.
Yes, indeed. That was nightmare enough for any man. One of us.
Yes.
Surely it must be so. Unless... A new idea suggested itself to my mind. Rapidly, I considered it. The light increased. For Rose's mysterious doings, his hints, they all fitted in. Fool that I was not to have thought of this possibility before, and what a relief for us all. No, John, I said, it isn't one of us. How could it be?
I know, but still, who else is there?
Can't you guess?
No.
I looked cautiously round and lowered my voice. Dr. Bauerstein, I whispered.
Impossible.
Not at all.
But what earthly interest could he have in my mother's death?
That I don't see, I confessed. But I'll tell you this. Poirot thinks so.
Poirot? Does he? How do you know?
I told him of Poirot's intense excitement on hearing that Dr. Bauerstein had been at Stiles on the fatal night, and added, he said twice, that alters everything. And I've been thinking. You know, Inglethorpe said he had put down the coffee in the hall. Well, it was just then that Bauerstein arrived. Isn't it possible that, as Inglethorpe brought him through the hall, the doctor dropped something into the coffee in passing?
Hmm,
said John.
It would have been very risky.
Yes, but it was possible.
And then, how could he know it was a coffee? No, old fellow, I don't think that will wash.
But I had remembered something else. You're quite right. That wasn't how it was done. Listen. And I then told him of the cocoa sample which Poirot had taken to be analysed. John interrupted just as I had done.
But look here, Bauerstein had it analysed already.
Yes, yes, that's the point. I didn't see it either until now. Don't you understand? Bauerstein had it analysed. That's just it. If Bauerstein's the murderer, nothing could be simpler than for him to substitute some ordinary cocoa for his sample and send that to be tested. And of course they would find no strychnine. But no one would dream of suspecting Bauerstein or think of taking another sample, except Poirot, I added with belated recognition.
Yes, but what about the bitter taste that cocoa won't disguise?
Well, with only his words for that. And there are other possibilities. He is admittedly one of the world's greatest toxicologists.
One of the world's greatest what? Say it again.
He knows more about poisons than almost anybody, I explained. Well, my idea is that perhaps he's found some way of making strychnine tasteless. Or it may not have been strychnine at all, but some obscure drug no one has ever heard of which produces much the same symptoms.
Yes, that might be,
said John.
But look here, how could he have got at the cocoa? That wasn't downstairs.
No, it wasn't, I admitted reluctantly. And then suddenly a dreadful possibility flashed through my mind. I hoped and prayed it would not occur to John also. I glanced sideways at him. He was frowning perplexedly, and I drew a deep breath of relief, for the terrible thought that had flashed across my mind was this, that Dr. Bauerstein might have had an accomplice. Yet surely it could not be. Surely no woman as beautiful as Mary Cavendish could be a murderess. Yet beautiful women had been known to poison. And suddenly I remember that first conversation at tea on the day of my arrival, and the gleam in her eyes as she had said that poison was a woman's weapon. How agitated she had been on that fatal Tuesday evening. Had Mrs. Inglethorpe discovered something between her and Bauerstein, and threatened to tell her husband? Was it to stop that denunciation that the crime had been committed? Then I remembered that enigmatical conversation between Poirot and Evelyn Howard. Was this what they had meant? Was this the monstrous possibility that Evelyn had tried not to believe? Yes, it all fitted in. No wonder Miss Howard had suggested hushing it up. Now I understood that unfinished sentence of hers, Emily herself, and in my heart I agreed with her. Would not Mrs. Inglethorpe have preferred to go unavenged rather than have such terrible dishonour fall upon the name of Cavendish?
There's another thing,
said John suddenly, and the unexpected sound of his voice made me start guiltily.
Something which makes me doubt if what you say can be true.
Was that? I asked, thankful that he had gone away from the subject of how the poison could have been introduced into the cocoa.
Why, the fact that Bauerstein demanded a post-mortem. He needn't have done so. Little Wilkins would have been quite content to let it go at heart disease.
Yes, I said doubtfully. But we don't know. Perhaps he thought it safer in the long run. Someone might have talked afterwards. Then the Home Office might have ordered exhumation. The whole thing would have come out then, and he would have been in an awkward position, for no one would have believed that a man of his reputation could have been deceived into calling it heart disease.
Yes, that's possible,
admitted John.
Still,
he added,
I'm blessed if I can see what his motive could have been.
I trembled. Look here, I said, I may be altogether wrong. And remember, all this is in confidence.
Oh, of course, that goes without saying.
We had walked as we talked, and now we passed through the little gate into the garden. Voices rose near at hand, for tea was spread out under the sycamore tree, as it had been on the day of my arrival. Cynthia was back from the hospital, and I placed my chair beside her and told her of Poirot's wish to visit the dispensary.
Of course, I'd love him to see it. He'd better come to tea there one day. I must fix it up with him. He's such a dear little man. But he is funny. He made me take the brooch out of my tie the other day and put it in again because he said it wasn't straight.
I laughed. It's quite a mania with him.
Yes, isn't it?
We were silent for a minute or two, and then glancing in the direction of Mary Cavendish and dropping her voice, Cynthia said,
Mr. Hastings?
Yes?
After tea, I want to talk to you.
Her glance at Mary had set me thinking. I fancied that between these two there existed very little sympathy. For the first time it occurred to me to wonder about the girl's future. Mrs. Inglethorpe had made no provisions of any kind for her, but I imagined that John and Mary would probably insist on her making her home with them, at any rate until the end of the war. John, I knew, was very fond of her, and would be sorry to let her go. John, who had gone into the house, now reappeared. His good-natured face wore an unaccustomed frown of anger.
Confound those detectives! I can't think what they're after. They've been in every room in the house, turning things inside out and upside down. It really is too bad. I suppose they took advantage of our all being out. I shall go for that fellow Jupp when I next see him. Lot of fool flies,
grunted Miss Howard. Lawrence opined that they had to make a show of doing something. Mary Cavendish said nothing. After tea, I invited Cynthia to come for a walk, and we sauntered off into the woods together. Well, I inquired as soon as we were protected from prying eyes by the leafy screen. With a sigh, Cynthia flung herself down and tossed off her hat. The sunlight, piercing through the branches, turned the auburn of her hair to quivering gold.
Mr. Hastings, you're always so kind, and you know such a lot.
It struck me at this moment that Cynthia was really a very charming girl, much more charming than Mary, who never said things of that kind. Well, I asked benignantly, as she hesitated.
I want to ask your advice. What shall I do?
Do?
Yes. You see, Aunt Emily always told me I should be provided for. I suppose she forgot, or didn't think she was likely to die. Anyway, I'm not provided for, and I don't know what to do. Do you think I ought to go away from here at once?
Good heavens, no. They don't want to part with you, I'm sure. Cynthia hesitated a moment, plucking up the grass with her tiny hands. Then she said,
Mrs. Cavendish does. She hates me.
Hates you? I cried, astonished. Cynthia nodded.
Yes. I don't know why, but she can't bear me. And he can't either.
There, I know you're wrong, I said warmly. On the contrary, John is very fond of you.
Oh, yes, John. I meant Lawrence. Not, of course, that I care whether Lawrence hates me or not. Still, it's rather horrid when no one loves you, isn't it?
But they do, Cynthia, dear, I said earnestly. I'm sure you are mistaken. Look, there is John and Miss Howard. Cynthia nodded rather gloomily.
Yes, John likes me, I think. And, of course, Evie. for all her gruff ways wouldn't be unkind to a fly. But Lawrence never speaks to me if he can help it, and Mary can hardly bring herself to be civil to me. She wants Evie to stay on, is beginning her to, but she doesn't want me, and I don't know what to do.
Suddenly, the poor child burst out crying. I don't know what possessed me. Her beauty, perhaps, as she sat there with the sunlight glitting down on her head. Perhaps the sense of relief at encountering someone who so obviously could have no connection with the tragedy. Perhaps honest pity for her youth and loneliness. Anyway, I leaned forward, and taking her little hand, I said awkwardly, "Marry me, Cynthia." Unwittingly, I had hit upon a sovereign remedy for her tears. She sat up at once, drew her hand away, and said with some asperity,
"Don't be silly."
I was a little annoyed. "I'm not being silly. I'm asking you to do me the honour of becoming my wife." To my intense surprise, Cynthia burst out laughing and called me a funny dear.
"It's perfectly sweet of you," she said, "but you know you don't want to."
"Yes, I do. I've got..."
"Never mind what you've got. You don't really want to, and I don't either."
"Well, of course, that settles it," I said stiffly. "But I don't see anything to laugh at. There's nothing funny about a proposal."
"No, indeed," said Cynthia. "Somebody might accept you next time. Goodbye. You've cheered me up very much."
And with a final uncontrollable burst of merriment, she vanished through the trees. Thinking over the interview, it struck me as being profoundly unsatisfactory. It occurred to me suddenly that I would go down to the village and look up Bauerstein. Somebody ought to be keeping an eye on the fellow. At the same time, it would be wise to allay any suspicions he might have as to his being suspected. I remembered how Poirot had relied on my diplomacy. Accordingly, I went to the little house with the apartments card inserted in the window, where I knew he lodged, and tapped on the door. An old woman came and opened it. "Good afternoon," I said pleasantly. "Is Dr. Bauerstein in?" She stared at me.
"Haven't you heard?"
"Heard what?"
"About him."
"What about him?"
"He's took."
"Took? Dead?"
"No, took by the police."
"By the police?" I gasped. "Do you mean they've arrested him?"
"Yes, that's it, and..."
I waited to hear no more, but tore up the village to find Poirot. Chapter 10. The Arrest. To my extreme annoyance, Poirot was not in, and the old Belgian who answered by a knock informed me that he believed he had gone to London. I was dumbfounded. What on earth could Poirot be doing in London? Was it a sudden decision on his part, or had he already made up his mind when he parted from me a few hours earlier? I retraced my steps to Stiles in some annoyance. With Poirot away, I was uncertain how to act. Had he foreseen this arrest? Had he not, in all probability, been the cause of it? Those questions I could not resolve. But in the meantime, what was I to do? Should I announce the arrest openly at Stiles or not? Though I did not acknowledge it to myself, the thought of Mary Cavendish was weighing on me. Would it not be a terrible shock to her? For the moment, I set aside utterly any suspicions of her. She could not be implicated. Otherwise I should have heard some hint of it. Of course, there was no possibility of being able permanently to conceal Dr. Bauerstein's arrest from her. It would be announced in every newspaper on the morrow. Still, I shrank from blurting it out. If only Poirot had been accessible, I could have asked his advice. What possessed him to go posting off to London in this unaccountable way? In spite of myself, my opinion of his sagacity was immeasurably heightened. I would never have dreamt of suspecting the doctor, had not Poirot put it into my head. Yes, decidedly, the little man was clever. After some reflecting, I decided to take John into my confidence, and leave him to make the matter public or not, as he thought fit. He gave vent to a prodigious whistle as I imparted the news.
"Great Scott! You were right, then. I couldn't believe it at the time. No, it is astonishing until you get used to the idea, and see how it makes everything fit in. Now, what are we to do? Of course it will be generally known tomorrow."
John reflected.
"Never mind," he said at last. "We won't say anything at present. There is no need. As you say, it will be known soon enough."
But to my intense surprise, on getting down early the next morning,
and eagerly opening the newspapers, there was not a word about the arrest. There was a column of mere padding about the Styles poison and case, but nothing further. It was rather inexplicable, but I suppose that, for some reason or other, Jap wished to keep it out of the papers. It worried me just a little, for it suggested the possibility that there might be further arrests to come. After breakfast, I decided to go down to the village and see if Poirot had returned yet. But before I could start, a well-known face blocked one of the windows, and the well-known voice said,
"Bonjour, mon ami."
"Poirot!" I exclaimed with relief, and seizing him by both hands, I dragged him into the room. I was never so glad to see anyone. "Listen, I have said nothing to anybody but John. Is that right?"
"My friend," replied Poirot, "I do not know what you are talking about."
"Dr. Bauerstein's arrest, of course," I answered impatiently.
"Is Bauerstein arrested, then?"
"Did you not know it?"
"Not the least in the world."
But pausing a moment, he added,
"Still, it does not surprise me. After all, we are only 4 miles from the coast."
"The coast?" I asked, puzzled. "What has that got to do with it?" Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"Surely it is obvious."
"Not to me. No doubt I am very dense, but I cannot see what the proximity of the coast has got to do with the murder of Mrs. Inglethorpe."
"Nothing at all, of course," replied Poirot, smiling. "But we were speaking of the arrest of Dr. Bauerstein."
"Well, he is arrested for the murder of Mrs. Inglethorpe."
"What?"
cried Poirot in apparently lively astonishment.
"Dr. Bauerstein arrested for the murder of Mrs. Inglethorpe?"
"Yes."
"Impossible. That would be too good a farce. Who told you that, my friend?"
"Well, no one exactly told me," I confessed. "But he's arrested."
"Oh, yes, very likely. But for espionage, mon ami."
"Espionage?" I gasped.
"Precisely."
"Not for poisoning Mrs. Inglethorpe?"
"Not unless our friend Jupp has taken leave of his senses," replied Poirot placidly.
But I thought you thought so, too." Poirot gave me one look which conveyed a wandering pity, and his full sense of the utter absurdity of such an idea. "Do you mean to say," I asked, slowly adapting myself to the new idea, "that Dr. Bauerstein is a spy?" Poirot nodded.
"Have you never suspected it?"
"It never entered my head."
"It did not strike you as peculiar that a famous London doctor should bury himself in a little village like this, and should be in the habit of walking about at all hours of the night, fully dressed?"
"No," I confessed, "I never thought of such a thing."
"He is, of course, a German by birth," said Poirot thoughtfully, "though he has practised so long in this country that nobody thinks of him as anything but an Englishman. He was naturalised about 15 years ago. A very clever man. A Jew, of course."
"The Black Guard," I cried indignantly.
"Not at all. He is, on the contrary, a patriot. Think what he stands to lose. I admire the man myself."
But I could not look at it in Poirot's philosophical way. "And this is the man with whom Mrs. Cavendish has been wandering about all over the country?" I cried indignantly.
"Yes. I should fancy he had found her very useful," remarked Poirot. "So long as gossip busied itself in coupling their names together, any other vagaries of the doctor's passed unobserved."
"Then you think he never really cared for her?" I asked eagerly, rather too eagerly, perhaps, under the circumstances.
"That, of course, I cannot say. But shall I tell you my own private opinion, Hastings?"
"Yes."
"Well, it is this. That Mrs. Cavendish does not care, and never has cared, one little jot about Dr. Bauerstein."
"Do you really think so?" I could not disguise my pleasure.
"I'm quite sure of it, and I will tell you why."
"Yes?"
"Because she cares for someone else, mon ami."
"Oh, what did he mean?" In spite of myself, an agreeable warmth spread over me. I'm not a vain man where women are concerned, but I remembered certain evidences too lightly thought of at the time, perhaps, but which certainly seemed to indicate... My pleasing thoughts were interrupted by the sudden entrance of Miss Howard. She glanced round hastily to make sure there was no one else in the room, and quickly produced an old sheet of brown paper. This she handed to Poirot, murmuring as she did so the cryptic words,
"On top of the wardrobe."
Then she hurriedly left the room. Poirot unfolded the sheet of paper eagerly and uttered an exclamation of satisfaction. He spread it out on the table.
"Come here, Hastings. Now tell me, what is that initial? J or L?"
It was a medium-sized sheet of paper, rather dusty, as though it had lain by for some time. But it was the label that was attracting Poirot's attention. At the top, it bore the printed stamp of Messrs. Parkson's, the well-known theatrical costumers, and it was addressed to, the debatable initial, Cavendish, Esquire, Styles Court, Styles, St. Mary, Essex.
"It might be T, or it might be L," I said after studying the thing for a minute or two. "It certainly isn't a J."
"Good,"
replied Poirot, folding up the paper again.
"I also am of your way of thinking. It is an L, depend upon it."
"Where did it come from?" I asked curiously. "Is it important?"
"Moderately so. It confirms a surmise of mine. Having deduced its existence, I set Miss Howard to search for it, and as you see, she has been successful."
"What did she mean by on the top of the wardrobe?"
"She meant,"
replied Poirot promptly,
"that she found it on top of a wardrobe."
"A funny place for a piece of brown paper," I mused.
"Not at all. The top of a wardrobe is an excellent place for brown paper and cardboard boxes. I have kept them there myself. Neatly arranged, there is nothing to offend the eye."
"Poirot," I asked earnestly, "have you made up your mind about this crime?"
"Yes. That is to say, I believe I know how it was committed."
"Ah!"
"Unfortunately, I have no proof beyond my surmise. Unless—"
With sudden energy, he caught me by the arm and whirled me down the hall, calling out in French in his excitement,
"Mademoiselle Dorcas! Mademoiselle Dorcas! Un moment, s'il vous plaît!"
Dorcas, quite flurried by the noise, came hurrying out of the pantry.
"My good Dorcas, I have an idea, a little idea, if it should prove justified. What magnificent chance! Tell me, on Monday, not Tuesday, Dorcas, but Monday, the day before the tragedy, did anything go wrong with Mrs. Ingethorpe's bell?"
Dorcas looked very surprised.
"Yes, sir, now you mention it, it did, though I don't know why you came to hear of it. A mouse or some such must have nibbled the wire through. The man came and put it right on Tuesday morning."
With a long-drawn exclamation of ecstasy, Poirot led the way back to the morning room.
"See you? One should not ask for outside proof. No, reason should be enough. But the flesh is weak. It is consolation to find that one is on the right track. Ah, oh, my friend, I'm like a giant refreshed. I run."